The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic, the News and Observer, and Our State magazine. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. What comes to mind when you think of Florida? Disney World? The Everglades? The Space Coast? Florida is certainly filled with travel destinations. Just look at the recent stories about spring break events, and that will show why the Sunshine State is a major tourist attraction. But did you know that Florida is also where an endangered cat is making a comeback in the face of a development boom that could threaten its survival? That's where we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler. Return of the Florida Panther is written by Douglas Main and appears in the April 2021 issue of National Geographic. Let me begin by reading the caption to the photo taken by photographer Carlton Ward Jr., which precedes the article. A male panther leaps over a creek at Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge in southwestern Florida. The rarely seen cats, which number only around 200, are reclaiming territory north of the Everglades, but their habitat is threatened by encroaching suburban sprawl. Now to our story. Welcome to Panther Country, Brian Kelly says when I meet him at a busy intersection in East Naples, Florida, a stone's throw from a gas station and an urgent care center. Kelly, a state panther biologist, points east into the sprawling subdivision where he lives. A panther was caught on camera just a quarter mile away, he says, and another one made it across the six-lane road we're standing beside. Yet another panther, an 8-year-old female named FP224, lives nearby. She's been hit by a car twice, breaking a leg each time. She was treated by veterinarians and released after both accidents. To look for signs of her, we drive to Kelly's house, next to a patch of forest where she recently denned and birthed at least 3 kittens. It's the wet season, when panther tracks typically are wiped out by rain, but we get lucky. There she is, Kelly says, pointing to large paw prints, about the size of my fist in the soft sand. We follow the prints through tall pines and palms festooned with air plants. A check of motion-triggered camera trap Kelly placed there reveals that FP224 walked by just before 9 p.m. That's 2 evenings earlier. Her tracks are thrilling to see, a reminder that Florida still has wilderness and large cats, some of them resilient enough to live unseen along the fringes of the expanding suburbs. Most Floridians will never see any signs of these predators, which weigh from 65 to 165 pounds, depending on sex, and can leap more than 10 yards in a single bound. But the panther, known to the Cherokee as Lord of the Forest, depends on the millions of acres of swamps, forest, and fields in southwestern and central Florida, many of which are at imminent risk of development. The Florida panther, classified as a subspecies of mountain lion or cougar, once ranged throughout most of the southeastern United States, but the animals were hunted aggressively, and by the 1970s they were only found in Florida, and their numbers had fallen to fewer than 30, making them highly vulnerable to inbreeding. They were within a whisker of going extinct, says Kelly, a slim man, often adorned in clothes bearing the insignia of his employer, Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Scientists back then hatched an unprecedented rescue plan. In the mid-1990s, they hired Texan Roy McBride, arguably the world's best mountain lion tracker, to capture 8 of the cats in Texas, all females, then release them into South Florida. 5 of them bred, and this infusion of genetic diversity reversed the panther's downward spiral. Populations grew slowly, and now there are about 200 individuals, most of them in a massive stretch of contiguous land south of the Caloosahatchee River, which stretches east from Fort Myers. It's one of the most dramatic conservation success stories in U.S. history, says Carlton Ward, Jr., a conservationist and photographer whose work is supported by the National Geographic Society.
But a variety of threats cloud the Panthers' future. And that includes car collisions and Panther-on-Panther territorial spats. And those are the two leading causes of death. About 25 of the cats are killed by vehicles each year, a reflection of how development and road construction threaten the species at a time when roughly 900 people are moving to Florida every day. Additionally, a new debilitating neurological condition with an unknown cause has afflicted more than a dozen panthers, alarming conservationists. There is also good news, however. Panthers are reclaiming some of their old territory. In 2016, scientists spotted a female north of the Caloosahatchee River for the first time since 1973. That was a milestone, wildlife biologist Jennifer Korn says, of the sighting in the Babcock Ranch Preserve. Unlike males, females don't travel far from their mother's home range, a major limiting factor in the animal's expansion. About a dozen panthers, a couple of dozen panthers, I should say, now live north of the Caloosahatchee, Kelly estimates, including a few females. The northward expansion is necessary for panthers to survive long term, but it's possible only if the Florida Wildlife Corridor, a patchwork of public and private lands that runs throughout the state, is preserved, Ward says. To make that possible, more conservation funding is needed to help landowners, mainly ranchers, prevent open spaces from becoming subdivisions, parking lots, and roads. At the center of the Panthers' northward recovery is a landscape known as the Everglade Headwaters, part of the watershed that supplies nearly 10 million Floridians. Some of the water that originates here reaches swamps to the south, and investments in protecting this area will help the Everglades as well, conservationists say. Many of the cats in Florida live on public lands, including Big Cypress National Preserve, Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, Fokatichi Strand Preserve State Park, and the Picayune Strand State Forest, which make up about 1,420 square miles. But these and nearby protected areas in South Florida cannot support a much larger population of these territorial animals, says state panther biologist Dave Honorato. Panthers may each need up to 200 square miles of territory in which to roam and hunt, he says. At the same time, populations of white-tailed deer, one of panthers' primary food sources, have dropped in areas of Big Cypress. That may be partly because of invasive Burmese pythons, which devour deer and other panther prey. As panthers strike out north of the Caloosahatchee River, they'll encounter land dominated by large ranches and farms. Roads cut through many of these areas, and the region is dotted with small, often expanding towns. One of the better-known cattle operations in South Central Florida is the 10,500-acre Buck Island Ranch, run by Gene Lawless, a sixth-generation Floridian. On a March morning, before sunrise, I head out on a horseback with Lawless, who's wearing a cowboy hat, boots, and blue jeans, along with his son, Laron, and a group of cowboys to round up cattle in grassland spotted with islands of cabbage, palm, and oak. Like many ranches, Buck Island, owned by the Archbold Biological Station, a nearby ecological research and education facility, provides critical habitat for wildlife, including panthers. As dogs bay and cattle are rounded up, I ask Lawless, who leads the Florida Cattlemen's Association, how ranchers view the panther. We're all pretty positive about them, he says. They're part of the landscape. Generally speaking, the rancher and the panther face a common enemy, development, particularly new housing. Every ranch owner has had an offer from developers, Lawless says, adding that the state is deeply personal. Ranches near Orlando, where he worked as a young man, have become subdivisions. Some see the panther's presence as a positive because it makes developing certain areas of land in the suburbs more difficult. On the endangered species list, do you see cowboy or rancher written on it? No, but we benefit from the protection afforded to the panther, says Elton Langford, a rancher who lives to the west near Arcadia. But some ranchers, especially to the south, where there are more panthers, are warier, says Alex Johns, a Seminole cattleman whose family has ranched since his ancestors poached cows from the Spanish in the 1500s. In this region, panthers occasionally eat calves. A study conducted at one ranch found panthers kill less than 1% of calves. Another study found the predators killed around 5%. Panthers sometimes are blamed for kills by coyotes, bears, and even buzzards, said Deborah Jansen, a Big Cypress National Preserve panther biologist who's worked with the feline since the early 1980s. Calf loss can stir resentment and even lead to retaliation, Cattleman John says. Making matters worse, the federal program that compensates ranchers for livestock losses because of panthers is flawed, he adds, describing a process in which the paperwork is difficult and time-consuming, and reimbursement often is not granted. David Schindel, a panther coordinator with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, agrees that the reimbursement program needs improvement, and he sees the two sides as allies. To save the panther, we have to save the rancher, he says. Panther advocates, Schindel adds, need to find a way to incentivize the presence of the animals on the land, which is mostly private north of the Caloosahatchee River. One way to do that is to encourage public and private investment in conservation easements, which buy up development rights while allowing the owners to continue farming and ranching. A more immediate danger to panthers, conservationists say, is a proposed major network of toll roads known as MCORs. Part of it would cut a 140-mile path from near Orlando to Naples. Staunchly opposed by conservationists and many ranchers, this section of the road would slice through areas of the wildlife corridor and some of the last undeveloped parts of interior southwestern Florida. On top of this, scientists have discovered a neurological condition called feline leukomyopathy, which affects panthers and bobcats in Florida. Affected animals often stumble or have trouble walking, and severe cases can lead to paralysis, starvation, and death. As of December 2020, 26 bobcats and 18 panthers are thought to have had the disease, according to state biologists. Three panthers have likely died from it in Big Cypress alone, Jansen says. The syndrome's cause is unknown, but theories include exposure to toxic chemicals or a pathogen such as a virus. Most animals with the disease have been found in areas bordering developed land. Seeing cases in more pristine areas such as Big Cypress is concerning, Jansen says. Because of the threats panthers face, Jansen thinks the future of the Florida panther is very much in question and is a major reason why expanding the cat's habitat is key. Kelly is more optimistic. If enough green spaces and wildlife corridor areas are protected, he says, panthers could make it all the way to northern Florida within decades and potentially spread to other states with rich panther habitat, including Georgia. In 2008, a male panther born near the Everglades made it into western Georgia, about 100 miles north of the Florida state line, before being shot by a deer hunter. In the meantime, Kelly and colleagues have placed around 100 cameras at various spots north of the Caloosahatchee to learn more about how and where panthers move. A female recently lumbered through the Fisheting Creek area, as well as another in Babcock, and both were seen with males. That's cause for celebration, Kelly says, because the coupled panthers often produce kittens. On a fall afternoon, I walk with Kelly through muddy, dense brush to the edge of a creek in Babcock Ranch Preserve. Pointing to a tangle of sable pines, he calls seeing a panther here a month before. We just stared at each other for about 20 minutes, says Kelly, who quickly realized it was a female by her small size and because she was wailing, a sign of being in heat. That was momentous, the first verified in-person sighting of a panther north of the Caloosahatchee River since the cougar tracker Roy McBride found an old female at Fisheting Creek in 1973. This newfound female was my white whale, Kelly says. Later, we take a swamp buggy through this area, 20 miles to the north, crossing flooded fields and meandering through thickets of palmetto and cypress hammocks. Wildlife here is plentiful. On a good day, you can see bears, otters, alligators, and bird species, including crested caracaras and swallow-tailed kites, all of which rely on the same wildlands as panthers. Kelly stops to check a recently placed camera looped around an oak tree. He flips through the photos and sandwiched within all the usual suspects. Coyotes, wild pigs, raccoons, deer is a photo of a panther, which passed by a few weeks earlier. And not just any panther, a lanky female never before spotted by biologists striding along the northern side of the fence, separating the creek from the adjoining ranch, and perhaps to a new life up north. Well, from sunny and sometimes stormy Florida, we head northwest to our largest state, Alaska. That's where writer Morgan Krakow, witnessed a spectacle of nature as his headline reads, "A Denali Glacier is speeding downhill, potentially hampering climbers and increasing flood risk." His story first appeared in the Anchorage Daily News and was reprinted in the April 11, 2021 weekend edition of the News and Observer. A Denali Glacier suddenly moving at a speedier clip is intriguing scientists, increasing the risk of nearby flooding and potentially closing off some climbing routes on the mountain this season. Muldrow Glacier, which begins on Denali's northeastern slope and flows to form the McKinley River, is experiencing a geologic phenomenon, a surge event. The glacier, which usually moves at an average or slow speed, is now jagged and covered with crevices as it stretches and moves 50 to 100 times faster than normal, according to the National Park Service. The event could affect a few mountaineers, one already canceled, who were scheduled to use the north approach to the mountain, and intensifies the risk of flooding along the McKinley River, according to the Park Service. The surge was first glimpsed by K2 aviation pilot Chris Palm while he was flying last month for Talkeetna-based company that does flight-seeing tours and glacier landings. "I was looking at the glacier and I was thinking it looks really difficult to get onto the glacier right now," Palm said Friday. It's all shattered and torn up and jagged ice and deep crevices everywhere." As Palm looked from farther away, he saw that a good portion of the glacier looked similarly uneven. He'd read about a surge event on the mountain 60 years ago and thought it could be reoccurring. Palm took a bunch of pictures and sent them to a geologist friend who forwarded the photos to colleagues. Palm was correct. The glacier was surging. "Despite expectations that the glacier would surge sometime soon, it's still exciting," said Guy Adema, a physical scientist with the Park Service who has long studied the glacier. "The certain surge of ice is not driven by climate change impacts. Instead," Adema said, "it's likely caused by the glacier's elevation change and water dynamics within the glacier. At the colder upper reaches of the glacier, there's quite a bit of snow and ice that doesn't move as freely as the warmer ice below it. As the ice above builds up, something triggers instability, moving the ice from upper to lower elevation in what's known as a surge," Adema said. "Before the surge, the ice was moving between 3 and 11 inches per day. Now it's moving 30 to 60 feet per day, according to satellite image analysis. During the last surge event in 1956 and 57, the glacier moved over 4 miles in a period of months." "It's a dynamic environment on a glacier during a surge," Adema said. "One might see things tumbling, hear crackling and boulders falling, and the glacier itself is jumbled and cracked as the surface gets pulled and stretched. It's gone from basically a very smooth, level ice surface to a totally impassable, creviced area," Adema said. "Only about 1% of the world's glaciers are considered surge type," he said, "though Denali has a particularly high proportion of them. During surges, water that builds up at the end of the glacier usually releases sometime in late spring or early summer. In the case of Muldrow Glacier, that water would run into the McKinley River and cause a short but significant increase in flow," Adema said. "But luckily, there are no buildings or residents directly downstream. The first Denali climbers of this year are expected to check in April 18th, and about 800 to 900 climbers total are expected, somewhat fewer than the pre-pandemic average of around 1,200, said Marine Gaultieri, a public information officer at Denali. "Most Denali climbers use the Kahilpna Glacier route on the southern side of Denali, but every year a small number head up the north side on a route that goes up to Muldrow Glacier, and the surge could make it extremely challenging or impossible with normal equipment," Adema said. "The surge is a dramatic and fascinating process where the earth changes a lot in a short amount of time," he added. "It's a spectacle of nature," he said. "In a place like Alaska," Adema said, the glacier surge acts as a reminder of our own humility and place within the landscape." Well, from Alaska's Denali, we're going to return home to the Tar Heel State. When you think about traveling in North Carolina, you might recall slogans like "From Murphy to Manio," or maybe "From the Mountains to the Coast." And if you go back a few years, you may remember "Variety Vacation Land." Well, indeed, there is a lot to see and do in our state, sometimes called the Old North State, by the way. Back in the early 2020, writer Robin Sanders took a trip to a sandhill city where she discovered vineyard views, Scottish culture, and fun shopping along Main Street. Her article, Five Reasons to Spend a Day in Laurinburg, North Carolina, appeared online at OurState.com on January 17, 2020. Let's see what she discovered. Standing tall, his feet planted in a wide V, 63-year-old Scott Medlin takes a deep breath. The Scottish bagpipe music fades away as he laces his fingers together and focuses on the task at hand. He bends down, scoops up the 20-foot-tall tree trunk caber that was just placed in front of him, and the 105-pound pole barely grazing his shoulder, steps forward with confidence before thrusting it up and out into the open field before him. "You can't let it drop, but if you're not afraid, you're okay," Madeline says. "You want to throw it at what's called 12 o'clock, so the top hits the ground directly in front of you, and it flips over end, perfectly straight." The president of North America's Maitland clan, Madeline is also director of athletics for Laurinburg's annual Scotland County Highland Games, where traditional Scottish events like the caber toss test the strength of representatives from 50 families. "It's the closest thing to going to Scotland without buying a plane ticket," says Bill Cottle, who first organized the event 12 years ago. In the 1970s, the Highland Games started out as trade fairs for immigrants just outside Laurinburg at a place called Laurel Hill, so this really is a revival of events that date back to the 1300s in Scotland. Laurinburg's annual Highland Games, held the first Saturday in October, may be the city's biggest tourist attraction. All our hotels are completely filled with competitors who come from all over the country, and even Canada, Caudill says, but it's not the only draw for history buffs and culture seekers. Read on for five reasons to plan a trip to this oak-shaded town tucked in the North Carolina sandhills. So let's see what they suggest. Relax, be you in retirement. Nestled along the pines in Laurinburg is Scotia Village, a continuing care retirement community where natural beauty and small-town charm blend together, offering premium amenities, engaging activities, and lifelong learning experiences. It's the perfect setting for an active retirement. Then trace your roots at the Scottish Heritage Center, home of the radio archive for the Thistle and Shamrock National Public Radio Program. The Scottish Heritage Center at St. Andrews University was created in 1989 to preserve Scottish heritage. My background is history and folklore, and I've always been interested in Scottish-American connections in this region, says Cottle, the center's director. We were the largest Highland Scots settlement well into the 19th century. There was a great exodus of immigrants from Scotland who had been cleared by their landlords, who were removing people to make room for more profitable sheep. According to Caudill, the Scottish Heritage Center is a clearinghouse for all things Scottish. Visitors can even sign up for piping, drumming, and Highland dance lessons, and as an archivist for the center's collection of rare materials related to Scottish-American history, genealogy, traditions, and culture, Caudill welcomes the challenge when visitors stop by to trace their Scottish connection and links. "I've had some epiphany-like experiences," he says. "A few years ago, a family was visiting from Texas, and after we spent some time looking through our geological resources, I was able to take them to their immigrant's ancestor's grave. It was a moving experience for these people who traced themselves to Scotland County, and I was able to take them to their first family member that settled here in the Carolinas." Join a tasting at Cypress Bend Vineyards. Just a 15-minute drive from Laurinburg, the 35 acres of fertile land that makes up Cypress Bend Vineyards was originally discovered by Scottish Reverend Daniel White and his wife Catherine Campbell White in 1807. Bordered by the Lumber River, it's the perfect spot for a muscadine vineyard. At least that's what Dan Smith, White's fourth-generation descendant, and his wife Tina thought when they decided to open Cypress Bend Vineyards in 2005. Today, the Smiths produce 14 different muscadine wines, and guests can try them all in their cozy tasting room or stone veranda. If you're spending a weekend in Laurinburg, plan to visit the vineyard on a jazzy Friday when live music, food truck, and romantic backdrop make sipping all the sweeter. Now, you can also attend the John Blue Cotton Festival, held annually on the second Saturday in October. This festival, with live music and handmade ice cream, gives revelers a glimpse into the 19th century farm life. On the grounds of the 1895 John Blue House, visitors can take a tour of the main home and explore the grounds' other structures. Log cabins, a mule-powered cotton gin, and restored country store, all before catching a train or hayride. John Blue is really representative of what these immigrants and their families made of themselves after just two centuries of being here, explains Caudill. His house shows some affluence, but about 21 yards away on the grounds, you can visit an immigrant cabin that's typical of an immigrant cabin you'd find carved out on a little piece of land. Now, you can also visit the Indian Museum of the Carolinas at the North Carolina Rural Heritage Center. Now, evidence of three Native American village types, Carolina Bays, Indian Mounds, and fishing villages, once prevalent along the Sandhills, is now on display at the Indian Museum of the Carolinas. An original canoe carved from a single log of longleaf pine, fish weirs, or traps made out of stone, and arrowheads all harken back to lives sustained through farming, fishing, and hunting. Visiting this museum at the Rural Heritage Center, guests can view 40 exhibits tracking the lives of these Native Americans since their earliest settlements in and around the Laurinburg region. And then you can spend a morning exploring downtown Main Street. On the corner of Church and Main, Laurinburg's art garden is quirky, fun, and colorful, the ideal welcome to a downtown that celebrates diversity. Start your morning browsing sculptures made by UNC Pembroke students, then wander down Main Street past historic brick buildings, stopping to check out an eclectic collection of businesses ranging from gift shops to clothing stores. Our downtown just feels like home, says development coordinator Daniel Walters. The business owners are always approachable, and they make it fun just to walk around and explore. While you're mosering, check out their scope out, rather, the lunch options. Jesse's has great subs. Jin Jin's, known for their Chinese food, and O'Shea's on Main Street is a local favorite for salads, sandwiches, wings, and burgers. For a full listing of downtown shops, you can just go online to downtown-laurinburg.com. That's downtown-laurinburg.com. So thank you, Robin Sutton Anders, for such a delightful tour of a Sandhills town. And finally, we're going to end the episode with a brief update titled More Finds from Ancient Lost City in Egypt Revealed. This one from the April 11, 2021 weekend edition of the News and Observer, written by Associated Press reporter Sammy Magny. Cairo, Egypt's best-known archaeologist, on Saturday, April 10th, revealed further details on a pharaonic city recently found in the southern province of Luxor. Zaha Hawass said his archaeologists found brick houses, artifacts, and tools from pharaonic times at the site of the 3,000-year-old lost city. It dates back to Amenhotep III of the 18th dynasty, whose reign is considered a golden era for ancient Egypt. This is really a large city that was lost. The inscription that was found inside here says that this city was the dazzling Aten, Hawass told reporters at the site. Archaeologists started excavating in the area last year, searching for the mortuary temple of Boy King Tut. However, within weeks, they found that mud brick formations that eventually turned out to be a well-preserved large city. So city walls and even rooms filled with ovens, storage pottery, and utensils used in daily life are said to be present. And we'll be getting more on that, I'm sure, in future stories, and we'll be reporting them here on Iron Chair Traveler. Well, that ends today's episode. I hope you've enjoyed it and hope that you'll be with us next week. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And it's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.